are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, May 1st, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Robin Marty, author of A Handbook for a Post-Roe America. Also on the program today, Bill Barr lied to Congress. Turns out he and Mueller not quite on the same page. Meanwhile, Joe Biden expands his polling leads as Democrats say policy schmolicy. Meanwhile, congressional committees threatening prison to reluctant former Trump advisor would-be witnesses. Inspector General finds that HUD impeded the Puerto Rican aid probe. Not the role of HUD to impede investigations into the failure to provide aid for Puerto Rico, just in case you were wondering. Julian Assange gets 1 year for jumping bail, awaits an extradition hearing tomorrow, I believe it starts. Meanwhile, Eric Prince, nay Blackwater, nay Jay, nay whatever they call it now, gets criminally referred to the Department of Justice by the House Intelligence Committee. And the ongoing, continuing fall of a right-wing con man. Turns out Jacob Wall also had some investment ideas. And speaking of falling, the Stephen Moore nomination implodes. Turns out he may actually be worse than Kane. And lastly, Venezuela, I don't know if in chaos is the right word, but Guaido wants yet another bite at the apple.
Hey guys, Juan Guaido here on Periscope. Wait for a few more people to chat in the stream. We're trying to do a coup. If people could get down to the army barracks, that would be rad. Thanks for all the likes. Oh, thanks. Oh, hey, what's up? Thank you. I heart you back.
Let's all get this. Those hearts going.
All this. And more on today's program.
Super chat donations appreciated. We have U.S. support, but all monetary contributions help.
Mike Pompeo was making some very weird noises yesterday. I mean, not like squeaks and, you know, fart noises or stuff like that, but he was saying some very strange things that, I mean, who knows in terms of our... I mean, I imagine we have some type of involvement right now, beyond, of course, the sanctions that we have imposed on Venezuela to punish the people of Venezuela for being the people of Venezuela, which apparently they should not have been. But in addition to the sanctions that we have to punish the people of Venezuela, I imagine we're engaged in other things. I don't know what they would be. As a government, but the question is, will there be less clandestine engagements, coming up? We don't know, but there's, like I say, Mike Pompeo was saying some pretty weird stuff yesterday. We will get to that later in the program. In the meantime, the Senate Judiciary Committee has been talking to Bill Barr, and Bill Barr is the Attorney General, most well known for his helping George Herbert Walker Bush extricate themselves from the Iran-Contra stuff and suggesting pardons and otherwise misleading Congress on a on several issues. On the eve of Barr testifying in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee today, the Washington Post got a story. Robert Mueller complained that Barr's letter did not capture context of Trump probe. Look, these things don't come out. It's two people who got that letter, right? One person who wrote it, one person who received it. Theoretically, there are other people on that sort of the chain of title, if you will, of that letter. But unlikely any of them would have in any way shown this letter to a reporter without one of those two principals permission. And I can't imagine that Bill Barr, who we will see in a moment just weeks ago, claimed that he had no idea what Mueller's thoughts were about his letter, Bill Barr's letter, to Congress in multiple different testimonies. Now, it's unclear. I mean, it's unclear exactly, I think, what Mueller was concerned about with the letter. We have yet to see the letter, but we've seen we've heard parts of it, I guess, or maybe it's been released this morning. By Bill Barr to the Senate committee. But clearly they were upset at Bill Barr's spinning. And it is a big deal for someone like Robert Mueller to put this stuff down on paper. It is a formal complaint. The idea that it's now been leaked to the press makes it even more formal. Bill Barr has been testifying. I don't know that I've ever seen a witness who's testified at any hearing so confidently, so blatantly, avoid answering questions as proficiently as Bill Barr. And quite clear why everybody in the White House was excited to get him, because he is as obstinate and I would imagine ethically challenged as Jeff Sessions, but clearly more talented.
Can you please slow down? Because I want to make sure I don't perjure myself.
Here, exactly. Let's go back to April 10th. Now, the letter was from when? April 4th? Was that what it was? The
Barr letter.
I'm sorry, not the Barr letter, but the Mueller letter was 2 or 3 days later, I guess. So April 10th would be, and April 9th would be days after Bill Barr received a letter from Robert Mueller saying, really don't appreciate the way that you're characterizing the report. Think it's misleading. And so here's Bill Barr lying to members of Congress. I mean, I guess you could call it, what was it that the White House, with the New York Times said the other day? Like sort of prevailing on the truth in a way that stretches things in a uncomfortable manner, something to that effect. Here's Chris Van Hollen asking Barr, ultimately, if Mueller supported his conclusion. Now, Barr spends a lot of time in this saying, well, it's not a conclusion. It was a non-summary of the findings.
Law, in fact, in making that assessment.
That's not a question I really can answer until I think.
Well, you did it, but you looked at the report, right? And you looked at the evidence of the report and you made a decision. And you said that the president's not guilty of criminal obstruction of justice. I'm asking you, in your review of the report, did you agree with Mueller that there were difficult issues of law and fact?
I'm going to give my reaction and comments, about the report after the report.
Well,
okay, so what Bill Barr is doing at this time, a couple of weeks ago, is he's trying to just have the only narrative out there is that there is no obstruction. We know, subsequent to this, we saw the report, and the report specifically said, we're not dealing with the question of obstruction, not because we don't have evidence of obstruction. In fact, we have 10 separate incidents which would constitute obstruction. But we also are very aware of the OLC's ruling that governs the DOJ that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And there are other constitutional mechanisms in which to hold the president to account. Those other constitutional mechanisms necessarily reside outside the DOJ. And all you need to do is go to the Constitution and find out what those mechanisms are, and they're impeachment. So Barr is making it out like I didn't make any conclusions, or I'm not going to talk about why I made the conclusions. It's not appropriate for me to talk about that now. And it's all part of a spin campaign. Go.
But you put your view of the report out there on this issue of obstruction of justice, right? Nobody asked you to do that.
What happened to our sound? Is the sound there? I'm not hearing any sound.
Evidence. Oh, okay. Did you agree with Mueller and his team that there were difficult issues of law and fact?
As I say, I am going to explain my decision. Yeah. And to the extent that requires any assessment of the Mueller report, I'm
going to do
that when
the
Mueller
decision,
report is out. I'm not
did your decision require you to look into the intent of the President of the United States with respect to obstruction of justice?
I'm not going to discuss my decision. I will lay it out after the report is out.
Mr. Attorney General, the thing is, you put this out there. I mean, the president went out and tweeted the next day that he was exonerated. That wasn't based on anything in the Mueller report with respect to obstruction of justice. That was based on your assessment. That was on March 24th. And now you won't elaborate at all as to how you reached that conclusion. Because I'm not asking you what's in the Mueller report. I'm asking about your conclusion. Let me ask you this.
Well,
you
it, was said the conclusion, it was the conclusion of a number of people, including me, and I obviously am the Attorney General. It was also the conclusion of the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein.
I understand. No, I've read
well
your letters.
Others, and I will discuss that decision after
did,
the report.
Did Bob Mueller support your conclusion?
I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion.
Well, at the very least, we know that Bob Mueller was unhappy with the way that those conclusions were presented. We know that for a fact at that point. Bill Barr did not answer that question. And then a couple of days later, he goes in front of the House committee and questioned by Chris Christie at the House Judiciary Committee. And this is what Bill Barr had to say further. At the very least, misleading Congress. I mean, this is a guy who is a professional liar. And he very adroitly, I think, avoids a perjuring himself. But he's got to be pretty adroit because he's certainly misleading Congress in a particularly acute way.
Reports have emerged recently.
Pause it.
General,
we should also say this is after the news reports that came out that members of Mueller's team were upset with the way that this letter had come out. Now, understand the way, you know, Bob Mueller is getting circles run around him, frankly, because he's trying to fight this through the press. And he's also but he's driving with the brakes on. The reason why members of Mueller's team came out and did that is because Mueller is still operating under some type of notion of like, I've got to maintain the integrity of the office and it's got to be secondhand and it's got to be at arm's length from me. And so Bill Barr takes the opportunity. I want you to listen to this carefully. Bill Barr knows that Mueller is upset about the way that his report, that Bill Barr's letter went out there because he's talked to Bill, to Mueller and he's gotten a letter from Mueller. But what Bill Barr has not done is talk to members of Mueller's team. So Chris Christie doesn't, I mean, excuse me, Charlie Crist doesn't realize that. He asked the question in the context of people of Mueller's team. Bill Barr only answers in regards to Mueller's team and avoids having to really address what the gist of the question is does Mueller have a problem with what you did?
Reports have emerged recently, General, that members of the special counsel's team are frustrated at some level with the limited information included in your March 24th letter, that it does not adequately or accurately necessarily portray the report's findings. Do you know what they're referencing with that?
No, I don't.
Pause it. So he doesn't know because he doesn't know what the members of Mueller's team thinks. He only knows that Mueller has that problem. Keep playing. Oh, that's it? Yeah, okay. So he's just basically arguing. He's just basically answering the very narrow question. I know what Mueller's problem is with it because I got a letter. But I don't know what people in Mueller's team is because I never heard from them. That's the game that they've been playing, and they've been playing it much, much better than certainly Mueller. Mueller was the only one who had this information. That's what's happening. I mean, and look, you know, this is from the very beginning. From the very beginning, every investigation of a president, every impeachment, whatever it is a political activity. It is not within our criminal justice system. You cannot indict a sitting president. At the very least, you cannot indict a sitting president under this Department of Justice. And so from the very beginning, this has been a political fight. And so to the extent that there have been excesses on either side, it is there. What they're doing is politicking. But for those who had argued that the atomic clock or whatever the nuclear clock is being implicated, or that Mueller and Bill Barr are best friends and Bill Barr would never lie about the Mueller report in any way, there's no daylight between them, or that this investigation, I guess, or maybe the hyping of the investigation or the nature of the coverage of the investigation somehow handed Donald Trump some type of big gift. None of that has been borne out. Did people get out over their skis in terms of, like, yes, they're backbenchers who tried to take advantage of it. That guy, Eric Swalwell, was on TV a lot. He may be one of three Democrats who don't make it into the debates because it didn't work for him, which I think also cuts into the assessment that somehow everyone was, like, caught up in the specific fever of conspiracy charges. It's quite clear that the Trump campaign was encouraging of Russian interference. I don't know that that made a difference in the context of the election. Certainly didn't help Hillary Clinton. But it's quite clear that the Trump White House, or I should say campaign, did that. Maybe they did it. Maybe he obstructed justice because he didn't want people to find out about his about the lies he had told about not having business in Russia, which he claimed throughout the entire campaign. Maybe Donald Trump knew that that $300-400 million tower in Russia was enough to get him to do just about anything to get that built, including sanctions he didn't care about, including who knows what. I mean, does anyone really think that this guy had fully formed opinions?
It's called geostrategy.
On geostrategy? Geostrategy. That were not tied into how much money am I going to make?
There's a hotel.
Right.
There's an agreement. There are many things.
Yeah.
Things.
Yes. And you make agreements.
Yeah, I don't think we're covering it because we're hanging all of our hopes on it. But, like, it does bear mentioning that the president could shoot someone in the middle of Fifth Avenue and he wouldn't be indicted.
That's right. And there is only one process, and that is through Congress. And Bill Barr subverted that process. Not, I mean, you can't do it officially. Congress can still take action. But it's a lot harder when the narrative is totally exonerated. Everything's obliterated. And in fact, that was not the intent of Bob Mueller when he submitted that report. And, you know, because under the Bill Barr regime, there is no way you can hold a president to account. We will get back to that later in the program. But I should tell you that today's support for today's show comes from Warby Parker. By engaging with customers directly through their website and retail stores, Warby Parker is able to provide high-quality, good-looking prescription eyewear at a fraction of the price. And that's not easy. We've talked in the past that there's a bit of a monopoly in that arena, and Warby Parker stands outside of it. Every pair is custom fit with an anti-reflective polycarbonate prescription lens starting at just $95. And Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs of glasses and try them on for 5 days. Everything ships free and includes a prepaid return shipping label, and there's no obligation to buy. I don't know if you remember. I think we did this like 4 or 5 years ago. And I think somewhere on the site, somewhere, their survey is still up with pictures of me in 5 different frames. And I ended up getting the metal frames. And then later, my eyes got even worse. I got Coke bottles, folks. But I still wear those when I'm doing stuff. I don't need to have like the old man glasses that I have. I don't want to talk about it. But the look of these glasses, these
really,
I have progressive lenses. I didn't want to bring them.
But style wise, I wouldn't describe them.
No,
way.
Oh no. And the Warby Parker ones are even significantly nicer. But the ease of the home try on thing was great, and you can even do a survey with your friends on Twitter if you want. Which one do you like best? Now on me. But check it out, folks. Great value, great glasses. Head to Warby. Why can't I ever say that? Warby Parker.com/majority to order your free home try-ons today. That's Warby Parker.com/majority. Do you have an iPhone X? Make sure to download Warby Parker's app where you can use their brand new virtual try-on. I may play with that. It allows you to try on glasses, seeing the realistic color, texture, and size of each style using just your phone. Check it out. We'll put a link, obviously, in the show notes today. Also, many times I've been in a situation where, particularly when I'm not with the kids, I forget to eat. I have one of these issues where, like, if you put a full meal in front of me, I can eat everything. I can eat all of it. But if I don't see the food, then I forget to eat it. So it's honestly, like, I'll go, like, it'll be 9 o'clock at night. I'll be at home and I'll be like, oh, I forgot to have dinner today.
Well,
and lunch.
I find that so hard to believe.
It's weird. It's weird because you see me around food and I can eat all of it.
You love treats.
I love it. Well, but if you find yourself at 10 o'clock at night and you're like, oh, damn it, I need some food. Well, Postmates is your personal food delivery service, but it's also your grocery delivery service, whatever kind of delivery service all year round. No more trips to the store. Anything you're craving, Postmates can deliver within the hour, 24 hours a day, 365 days a year. This is nuts. They're the largest on-demand network in the U.S., offer delivery from all the restaurants, grocery, convenience stores, traditional retailers you could possibly need. Simply download the app for iOS or Android for free. Browse local restaurants and businesses. Track your delivery in real time. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners, what? $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you use the code REPORT. That's the code REPORT. For $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Download Postmates app, save with the code REPORT. You gotta download the app and use the code REPORT. Also, just a reminder, we are now 11 days away from Mother's Day. And there's nothing I would hope, Michael, there's nothing we wouldn't do to make sure the special moms in our lives are happy.
Are you kidding me?
I'm just...
Of course.
Sherry's Berries has special Mother's Day berries designed just for mom. They're topped with chocolate chips, pink shimmer sugar, and swizzles. I can't even talk about it without getting a little bit exercised. And you choose your delivery date to ensure that mom gets your gift of Shari Berries exactly when you want her to. So this is perfect. You're thinking about it right now. Just go to berries.com, berries.com. Hit the microphone, use the code CEDAR, order it, and have it delivered the day of or day before Mother's Day. Your satisfaction is always guaranteed. These berries, they're like, they're chocolate dipped berries. They're delicious. I'm going to have my kids actually get them for their mother. Yeah, that's a nice thing for me to do.
Yes.
Particularly
points in the war.
Yeah. Points of the war, exactly. Don't wait to the last minute on this one. Visit berries.com today. Order your freshly dipped strawberries starting at just $19.99 for the moms in your life. And to make mom really happy, you can double the berries for just $10 more. You know what? I'm going to get them for my mom, too. I don't know why. Like, it doesn't occur to me. Like, but I think she's, who doesn't love strawberries with chocolate? Mother's Psychos. Day, Sunday, yeah, exactly, May 12th. That's actually the way you can find out if you have a sociopath in your midst. Just see if they don't eat strawberries dipped in chocolate. Berries.com, berries.com. Click on the microphone, upper right-hand corner, enter the code CEDAR, S-E-D-E-R. That's berries.com. Click the microphone, code CEDAR. Do it now so you don't forget. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be talking to Robin Marty on the post-Roe America that we are very likely headed to. We'll be right back after this. Oh, I can explain what you want from me. I do it anyway. What you give to me, I know you spare with ease. You cough it up sometimes, and never just for me. That's the way it's always been. In summer, summer, down in Chico, Chico, you got We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program independent journalist and author of Handbook for a Post-Roe America, Robin Marty. Robin, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me on, Sam.
You know, I'm fascinated by this because I think Kavanaugh, but before that, I think it was a fairly safe assumption that we are headed to an era where, if not directly overturned Roe v. Wade, certainly the right curtailed in such a matter as to be effectively overturned.
Yeah,
I suspect that's your belief.
Exactly what's going on right now. Yeah. Obviously, the intention is that Roe is going to be overturned, in which case we have at least 15 states that will make abortion completely illegal. We have about 10 states that will make abortion completely legal, and the rest will fall in between. But what's really interesting right now is if you watch this surge of so-called heartbeat bans that are happening in states across the country, those are all fail-safe bills. And what they are is they are an attempt to make sure that if for some reason the Supreme Court does not decide to overturn Roe v. Wade, they can still essentially ban abortion in their states. What they're playing on is this idea that the Supreme Court could potentially say, all right, we are going to keep abortion legal all throughout the United States. However, states can do whatever it is they want to do as long as they do not officially completely ban abortion. So with that happening, that's why we're seeing Mississippi, Louisiana just introduced one now. Every state in the South, in the Gulf area, and then many of them through the Midwest are all doing these heartbeat bans, knowing that if the Roe is upheld and abortion stays legal, they can still basically ban it completely within their states.
And I noticed that today, I guess, or maybe it was yesterday, that Alabama at least passed the House of Representatives a bill making it a crime for a doctor to perform an abortion. And I would imagine also we're going to see like trap laws, right? Like these, anything that makes it just that much harder to, from a practical standpoint, to provide an abortion will be found to be the scrutiny in which a state's restriction or regulations around it will be lowered. The scrutiny will be lowered, and therefore this is just going to be chipped away. I mean, this is almost inevitable. It's just really a question of like how blatant, right?
And what's really interesting about the idea of trap laws is the fact that we're not even 2 years out from the Supreme Court saying that trap laws are not constitutional. We already had the ruling in Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt in 2016 that said, no, you cannot use regulations or use extra scrutiny on doctors in order to close abortion clinics and make abortion inaccessible. Despite this fact, we've had the Fifth Circuit in Louisiana say, you know what, I think we should go ahead and revisit that. And so we're still waiting for this new makeup of the Supreme Court to decide whether they're going to uphold Whole Women's Health or if they're just going to toss that one aside as well.
And just to be clear, the trap laws and the Hellerstedt, I think, was in Texas. And I can't remember if that was physicians needed admission rights into a local hospital or, but there's other stuff to the effect of like, abortion clinics need to have 11-foot ceilings or something to that, right? I mean,
So Whole Women's Health v. Hellerstedt actually said that both of those were unconstitutional. However, we've already seen other states that are trying to go around it in other directions. One really good example is that few people have noticed that in Ohio, more than half of the state's clinics have closed over the last 5 years. And that has happened because what they're doing is they have transfer agreements, which are essentially the same thing as this admitting privileges law, but the Board of Health is shutting down each one by one. And because of that, there has been no scrutiny over this because there is no point in which they say that they've actually reached an undue burden yet. So because they do it one by one, they can keep going. And then when the court finally says, okay, that one clinic was too many and now it's an undue burden to the right to access an abortion, then they're basically as close as they could be without going over.
Okay, so now my understanding is that you think that that an overturning of Roe would be a good thing. Is that relative to, you know, what we're seeing in Ohio or these sort of like when it's chipped away, it's hard, you know, there's no headline of the day. It's very hard to rally people around in Ohio that one by one, the health inspector is shutting down these clinics. And so it's very difficult to sort of like make people aware of how this right is being taken away and to rally against it.
Yeah, because one of the things that we've already seen on the ground is, especially since 2010, but even before that, it's been nearly impossible for many communities, especially rural communities and communities of color and communities of low economic standing, to be able to access abortion as it is. It's too expensive. There's too many hoops to jump through. All of these things make it too hard for people who need abortions to be able to get to them. Yet abortion is still legal in all of these places. What we need are these really big wake-up calls that will help make people who are less affected by abortion restrictions understand that this is a fight that they have and be engaged with now. And we saw that immediately after Trump was elected, when millions of women came out, not just in D.C., but across the country, and marched in order to say, no, you are not going to take our rights away right now. And then we saw it again when people came out when Kavanaugh was up for appointment, and people were coming into D.C. and they were being arrested. There was this huge moment where everybody understood this is a point of change. I believe personally that in a lot of cases, it is too hard for people to access abortion. It's why we are seeing so much of an uptick of people trying to access it by buying medication online, people trying to do things themselves, people already leaving states in order to get to other states in order to get care. Should we hit a point where Roe is officially overturned and people understand, okay, these states do not have any care whatsoever? And we're talking about not just like a state here or a state there, but an entire swath of the country that is going to have no care, basically from the edge of New Mexico all the way out to Florida. There will be no legal abortion there. When that happens, it's unavoidable. When that happens, it's a rallying point. And unfortunately, I feel like although activists right now are doing so much good to try and make sure that people are getting access, there's just only so much that can be done until the people of privilege really recognize that this is a problem and step up.
All right. Well, that seems to me to be a big dilemma, to even in the event that Roe is overturned, or even in the worser case, as it were, that it is de facto overturned, but nominally not overturned, which is that, you know, when we talk about Alabama, when we talk about Mississippi, when we talk about Missouri, we talk about, Louisiana, we're talking about, like you say, women who are maybe living in poverty and don't have access to this care. When we talk about the states where it will still be legal, we're talking about the bigger, the wealthier states, right? Where presumably folks of privilege are living and will not have the same experience because it won't be in the local news. It won't be in the to the extent that it's even in the national news, because the national media is centered around those areas where abortion will more than likely still be legal. How does that word get out? I mean, effectively now there's a couple of states, like you say, where abortion is almost effectively unattainable, but yet very few people are conscious of that.
So what we need to do is make sure that abortion becomes a much bigger platform, especially when we head into the 2020 elections. We need to make sure that every candidate knows how to answer questions about abortion. One of the things that is going to be probably the biggest factor of 2020 is the fact that the right has already decided that they are going to define everything by infanticide, that they are going to only talk about abortion as it comes to third trimester abortions, and they're going to conflate everything that happens after a first trimester to be a so-called late-term abortion, which does not exist. Our politicians need to know how to talk about this. They need to know how to talk about abortion as a right that belongs to everyone, and that isn't just something that people unfortunately have to have, that it needs to be considered a part of healthcare. It can't be divorced from it. And in a lot of ways, it needs not just to be clinic-based, because regardless of what happens with abortion law, as long as abortion can only exist by going to an abortion clinic rather than through purchasing online, doing telemed, as long as it's restricted to just a clinic, then the right knows that all they have to do is close a clinic, be it through regulations, through zoning, through violence. If they can close a clinic, then they can cut off healthcare access. We need to be sure that everybody understands that this is not just a rural problem or not just a Midwest or a South. This is how they will close clinics in New York. This is how they will close clinics in California. They will close clinics everywhere because all it takes is to take them out one by one and no one will have care. We need to expand access beyond just clinics.
Okay, I want to circle back to that, but let's start with the question of late-term abortion and infanticide. I am very confident that there's nobody who supports the idea of just deciding after the birth of a child that you can wrap it up. I think, as Donald Trump said it, the at a rally the other night in Ohio, wrap it up, and then decide to kill it, kill the baby. That doesn't happen. When we talk about, when people say late-term abortion, we're talking about dilation and extraction. Explain to us what that process is, and give us some numbers here, because, I mean, it seems to me that there are, and tell me if I'm wrong, my understanding is that there are third trimester abortions that take place when a mother maybe was unable to get an abortion earlier, was unaware that she was pregnant. I mean, they're extremely rare, but they do happen when a woman's health is not necessarily implicated. Just discuss that. I mean, what, in to the extent that they exist.
So the first thing that we have to talk about is we have to straighten out all of our terms. There's no such thing as late term abortion because term means 40 weeks. And so late term would be after 40 weeks. So that does not exist. When we are talking from a progressive standpoint and we use the term late term abortion, even though we shouldn't be, what we are usually trying to reference is the idea of third trimester abortions.
Right.
The first thing that we have to understand is that when the right is saying late term abortion, they are in fact referring to anything after the first trimester. So that is how things are getting conflated and how you're finding stories of, then they'll start to say, okay, well, look at all these statistics about abortions after 20 weeks and why people have them. The thing is, 20 weeks is not viability. 24 weeks is the point in which science believes that viability is a likelihood. And viability is the point in which, with medical care, there is a 50% chance of survival in order to live outside the womb. So we're already talking on different levels of definition, and those have to be straightened out. When you get to a third trimester abortion, a third trimester abortion is almost always going to be a labor induction. There is not D&E, dilation and evacuation, because at that point, the fetus is too developed to do that. So when we are having a third trimester abortion, it's going to be a labor induction. That would be a third trimester abortion would be the only point in which, yes, it could be possible that a fetus that is born at that point would survive the abortion. But because of the way that the procedure is done, fetal demise is always done first. So first there would be an injection to the heart. They would make sure that there was no longer a heartbeat, and they would do all of that before any sort of process to open up the cervix and then induce the labor. So when we're looking at third trimester abortions or abortions after viability, they are in that case always going to be because of the health of a pregnant person or because of a fetal anomaly. We do not have elective third trimester abortions. It just doesn't happen.
Is it illegal, or are you saying it just doesn't happen?
According to Roe, you are allowed to have abortion in the first trimester. You are allowed to have abortion in the second trimester for special indications. And in the third trimester, it is only for the physical or mental health of the person who is carrying it. Mental health in almost all circumstances refers to, okay, there is a fetus with an anomaly. It is more detrimental to this person to be able to be forced to carry to term and give birth to this than to just go ahead and end that pregnancy.
Okay. Fair enough. I mean, so that, I mean, that I think it's important for people to really understand, because as you say, there's a lot of conflation of a lot of different things.
That happens on the other side, because what they'll do is they'll start talking about, okay, so we're having late abortions, and look, here are the stats that say, here are these people who have abortions after 20 weeks that say it's because they couldn't access a clinic early enough, or say that it was because they didn't know they were pregnant, all of these other things. But they're talking about statistics that aren't specifically for the third trimester. They're talking about statistics that are any point after the 20 weeks.
Okay.
And so because of that, they're conflating second trimester and third trimester abortions, which are done under completely different circumstances and laws.
And we should also add that these abortions take place essentially after consultation with a doctor, between a doctor and their patient. Right. I mean,
exactly.
This is not like you don't just go in and, you know, go online and register for it like you're going in for, you know, a, I guess, a, you know, I don't know, a haircut or something.
Right.
You are actually in consultation, particularly in the context of the third trimester, with a doctor to assess whether your need for an abortion crosses that threshold.
Exactly. And if we want to talk specifically about the New York abortion law, which is where this whole thing got started, the thing that a lot of people have lost track of is that when New York passed their new abortion law, what they were doing is they were allowing people who were in the third trimester to be able to obtain abortions with just one doctor saying that it was okay to have an abortion. Because before that, it took three doctors saying that it was okay to have an abortion. I'm sorry, not New York, in Virginia, the
right.
law that they fought over, and then it got stalled because that was the only change that they were trying to make. It wasn't even, hey, you can have an elective third trimester abortion. It was, you only need to get one doctor to consent to this abortion. You don't need a full panel. And this whole idea of a panel approving an abortion goes back to the days pre-Roe when people were trying to get abortions and they were illegal. And so you had to go up to a hospital and give them the entire story of why abortion mattered for you, but not for being legal for everybody. And so in a lot of ways, it just harkens back to this age of, it's not that we want to make sure that abortion can't be had by anybody. It's just we want to be able to pick and choose whether we think that your abortion is valid or not.
Okay. So with that clarified, let's talk about what we're looking at in a, and I think it's a little bit easier. It's a little bit more low hanging the fruit, as it were, if, you know, a Supreme Court says we're overturning Roe v. Wade. End of story. Forget about it. Completely thrown to the states. Anywhere that they want to ban abortions totally, they can do it. That's a little bit easier to imagine what happens.
Yes.
If it doesn't happen that way, if it's simply like it's OK for states to pass trap laws, that we're just not going to give that measure of scrutiny. What, all right, now we're getting into the handbook a little bit. What do we do as women? What do we do as men, in the context of, you know, activists and also people who need this health procedure?
Right. So the most important thing that I talk about in the handbook over and over again is the idea that we are not in as nearly dire of straits as we think that we are, because there is a system that is already out there and already exists, already networks people together in order to make sure that people can get from one state to another state if a person needs abortion care. Reproductive justice groups have been doing this work on the ground for decades already and have been doing it with little resources in their communities, helping their own communities because they know them best. So what we have are abortion funds, we have practical support groups, we have clinic escorts, we have all of these people on the ground, especially in low access states, who know how to get somebody to a different clinic, how to put them up in a home, how to drive them to a different place. These are all places that exist, and that as activists, if we are new to the movement and want to do something to help, we can find them and plug ourselves into already existing work. This is good because it means that we do not have to spend the resources to try and create an entire network. It's already out there. So as people who are seeking out abortions, the first thing that we're going to need to do is it's best to try and figure out ahead of time some sort of plan. One of the things that I recommend is that people try to figure out where their nearest abortion clinic is going to be, what sort of restrictions might be there, how much money they might need for an abortion. Another thing that I tell a lot of people right now, to be completely honest, is it is not a bad idea to treat medication abortion like you would emergency contraception. The biggest problem with medication abortion at this moment isn't that it's a health risk, because it's not. It's that it is a legal risk. And especially in states where a person could be under investigation for having a miscarriage, that could be a problem for you. However, the other big problem right now is the fact that getting that medication online can take a long time. The FDA is already cracking down on places that are offering it into people in the United States. Those are closing. New ones have popped up, but even still, we're seeing that it can take 4 to 6 weeks for somebody to get medication that orders it online.
And you have to trust it, right? I mean, Yeah, I think these things are eminently trustable and certainly, but you don't know the agency, right? You don't have that presumption that you have, within the states, I guess.
There are groups out there that have worked on vetted information to make sure that, so they order pills themselves in order to test the materials that come through, see how long things are going to take, make sure that they do actually provide what they say that they're going to provide. Plan C is a group that does that online, and they have a report card, and they update the report card as different pharmacies disappear and other pharmacies pop up. Again, it's still a long waiting period, and so I often tell people that if they think that this might be something that they will need to do down the road, it does not hurt to purchase pills off of a vetted supplier on the Plan C report card, have that medication in case you need it, and if you do not, somebody else might need it, and then you can get it to them in a timely manner, and you can purchase another one yourself. I don't see any reason why medication abortion should not be treated in the same way as emergency contraception. In Canada now, they have decided that they no longer need to have an ultrasound before a person takes medication abortion. And in the United States, there is absolutely no concern about medical risks other than the fact that a person who might have complications could feel insecure about the idea of going in for follow-up care. In which case they just need to know that there is nothing that they have taken that will show up in blood work or urine work, and that all they need to say is, I think I'm pregnant, I think I'm having a miscarriage, and I'm scared.
Right. And let's talk just a little bit about, I think, the general preference for clinics and surgical procedures in the context of abortion, because that is, I mean, it just seems culturally that is what we're used to. I mean, what do we do about that?
Yeah, there is a lot of benefits to having a vacuum aspiration rather than a medication abortion. For one thing, it's a lot easier. It's not more medically unsafe, if that makes sense. So if done in a clinic, it's very safe. It's quick and it's done. And there is a lot of mental well-being to the fact of knowing that you go into a clinic and you come out and you're not pregnant. Whereas with medication abortion, you are involved in that abortion. It will take a while. It will be lots of blood. It will be a labor, a miscarriage. So yes, there is a huge advantage for a lot of people in being able to access a clinic and be able to get a safe vacuum aspiration abortion. And also, medication abortion does not work as well when a person is in the second trimester. So that's another advantage. We need to work as hard as possible to keep our clinics open. And one of the things that we're seeing right now that is actually really making me feel a lot better than if you had talked to me 6 months ago, are things like the state of Kansas just reaffirmed that the state constitution says there is a right to an abortion. So as long as the state is not capable of amending their constitution, Kansas will have abortion regardless of what happens federally. Iowa has the same rights. As long as that is not amended, Iowa will have the right to an abortion. We're seeing more states that we did not expect to keep a right to an abortion find that their state constitutions have it.
Is there a provision I wonder about the concept of clinics that are designed specifically to receive women who have begun a medically induced abortion.
So that was actually something that we saw happen quite a bit in Texas when the clinics had all closed, especially when the clinics in the Rio Grande Valley had closed. El Paso ended up with a clinic that was open solely for people who had begun, who were experiencing any sort of miscarriage issue. And one of the things that I want to make really clear is the fact that if a person is having a miscarriage, they do not have to go into a hospital. An abortion clinic can help them as well and can probably do it much more cheaply. It's just, it's not something that people who are pregnant with wanted pregnancies tend to think about. So what would happen is that, yes, people who were trying to induce on their own would begin to bleed, would get concerned, and would go into this clinic in El Paso, and they were able to finish it up with a vacuum aspiration. That's a thing that could work and really should be in existence, especially if we hit a post-Roe era. One of the issues is that this is also going to be something that is going to be highly, highly scrutinized, because the right has already looked at this idea of miscarriage management as being a way of just hiding abortions. And they're already looking at statistics of clinics that have and have announced that they have done miscarriage management and saying, oh, well, we don't believe that was actually a miscarriage. That was obviously just an abortion that was being done in secret.
And so when people hear about various states, and we've heard this over the years of state legislators trying to pass laws about, you know, the police, you need to file a report when you have a miscarriage or something to that effect with the police. This is a way of intimidating women from exercising this option, particularly of a medically induced abortion. All right. Well, so let me ask you this. So two things. One is, assuming that there is a either an effective or a total overturning of Roe v. Wade, what is the do you have a sense of the legal strategy? We may be decades away before that legal strategy can be in play, at least on the Supreme Court level. But to the extent that there is one or there is possibility, is there a legal strategy to come back after that? A and B. What about the symbolic implications of, I mean, Roe v. Wade made a material and practical difference in women's lives, but it also was a statement that women have rights over, you know, sovereignty over their own body, that it also opened up a whole understanding that reproductive rights was also economic rights. What supplants that?
So to go to your first question, what we would see happening when Roe is overturned is probably a state-by-state level of counter to try and get state constitutions to once more include the right to an abortion. What we do need to think about, though, is Roe being overturned is not an end game for the right. What they want is an amendment to the Constitution, a personhood amendment to the federal Constitution, so that abortion is completely illegal all across the country. And once that happens, then that would be addressed in the same way that we just saw in Ireland, where they overturned the Eighth Amendment and then made abortion legal in the country and made a right to an abortion legal all throughout the entire country. So the right only, well, let me rephrase. Part of the right is only just getting started when it comes to the idea of overturning Roe v. Wade, because what they really want to do is make sure that there is a complete and utter federal ban on abortion all over the country. The thing is, I would say that the anti-abortion extremists want this, but the Republicans in general do not. And they do not want this because abortion is the easiest way for them to pick up votes in an election. Abortion is the reason why Trump is president right now, and abortion, quite frankly, will be the only reason that he can get reelected if it happens. And they don't want to give up something so easy. They have so many people, especially the people who call themselves pro-life Democrats, who will go out and vote against absolutely every progressive value that they believe in, just as long as they believe that they are saving babies. The right doesn't want to get rid of that. They don't want to lose that low-hanging fruit. So in my opinion, there's never going to be a federal law that makes abortion completely illegal.
Okay, and the second part, the sort of the symbolic nature of a federal understanding, a national understanding that a woman has sovereignty over her own body.
I mean, inherently, that's what the Equal Right Amendment is. And that's something that we still need to push and make happen. And that's something that they're fighting for in Congress right now. And that's why the same people who are opposing it right now are, they changed their language as to why they oppose it. But in general, it's the religious right, and they do not like the ERA because it interferes with their belief that traditional family values means that there is a man who works and a woman who stays home and takes care of the children. And that's how God intended this family to be.
The book is Handbook for a Post-Roe America. Robin Marty, thanks for talking to us about it. We will put a link at majority.fm. This is, and you predict, I think that this is going to happen in 2021 after the election. Really, and it really isn't implicated by the election at this point. There's five votes there, at least. There could be, there could be six, theoretically, and one of those five could be even a younger, more conservative, maybe, than even Clarence Thomas. There's a certain inevitability about this, and really important to address. I appreciate your time today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Head into the fun half of the program. I don't know if it's going to be that much funner. We will have we'll hear from some senators in anticipation of them talking to Bill Barr in this committee hearing. The earlier we saw Sheldon Whitehouse with Bill Barr, and Whitehouse was a little flummoxed because he couldn't believe how evasive Bill Barr was being. It was one of those moments like, you realize you're on TV, right? I mean, people can see this, but they also know. I mean, we're living in a very, it is a very, very difficult time to try and leverage reasonableness, to leverage shame. I mean, the Republican strategy increasingly over the years has been, if we are shameless, we're unstoppable. And it seems to be fairly effective. We will look into that. We'll talk a little bit about the implosion of Stephen Moore. This is.
He's going out with a bang.
This is unbelievable. It really is, this guy. And I mean, again, you know, we assume that the Republican Party is going to be like, no. And it's the interesting thing is it's not going to be because of all the reasons why we think he's atrocious. It's not going to be because of, like, he thinks that women really should not be a part of the job market, or that black people or that he's like, you know, enjoys telling racist jokes in public. That's going to be the pretense for the Republicans, who are just like, the guy is completely unqualified and the Fed's a little bit important to our very wealthy donors. But we will get to that in a bit. Just a reminder, you can support this show by becoming a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, not only are you supporting the free show, and not only are you getting extra content every day, but it's commercial free. Now, a lot of people come and they complain to me, Sam, I don't get a chance to hear your commercial reads anymore. Or I don't get a deal. I want a deal. I want, what did we do today? I want
Wobby Packy,
dude. Packy.
Wobby Packy.
Wobby Packy. Or I want the...
That's actually a great concept.
What's that?
Some type of like online-based New Hampshire Packy store.
That's right. Wobby Packy. Or I want the discount from berries.com with the coupon code CEDAR because it's Mother's Day. Or I want to use Postmates and get $100 free of credit, and by using the code report. And while you're at it, Sam, why do you always use different codes? Why don't you just have one code, majority report? But that's not the way it works. I don't get to choose. I don't know why they do.
Way too simple that way.
Way too simple. But you can always, once you become a member and you don't have to hear the ads and you get your news much quicker, you can always go to the show descriptions, and we keep that in both the members post, right, and the public post. So you can always check it out there. So you get extra content, you get it commercial free, and you're supporting the show. And you're like on the inside. You can't really tell, but it's a feeling that's inside of you. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. Get the MR blend. You'll enjoy it. Last night was Tuesday night. Michael, my understanding is you had a show.
It was an excellent, great show and a fantastic time. Dr. Maitha Alhassan joined me, and we talked about Malcolm X and linked that to the uprisings in Sudan and Algeria happening today. Then Anna Kasparian stopped by the studio, first time in the studio here. And
Was she impressed with the studio?
She actually was.
Yeah, she should be.
Well,
I mean, it's not like we got the...
It was great.
I remember the old Wilshire Boulevard set they had for...
That's what she said.
It reminds her of that, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. And, of course, we made fun of Dave Rubin. We had a new Dave Rubin. This is the most YouTube thing ever. We had Anna's reaction to Dave's reaction to her reaction to him.
Right.
That was fun. And then we had a whole bunch of other stuff to cover. Biden, Buttigieg. We played some of this new Lula interview in the post game. New character, actually, very much in the Jamiosphere. Tanky Bill Maher. Calling for, like, this guy, Juan Guaido, this people.
Is Bill Maher still around?
Yes. That's what made it funny.
I'm into it.
These people who think they can wage a coup. We had a lot of fun. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. We also, before, we did a special, not typically, but at 6 p.m., we did a live stream with Nando Vila to break down the Spanish election results because... there was some pretty significant signals coming out of Spain.
Jamie?
This week on the Antifada. I forgot to promote this yesterday because it came out over the break, but it's very good, and I hope everybody listens to it. We spoke with our good friend Natasha Leonard about her new book, Being Numerous, Essays on Anti-Fascist Life. So if you've never listened to the Antifada before and you think that it's only about Antifa, this episode will not prove you wrong. We also released a bonus with Tosh later in the week where we talk about electoralism, the DSA, and why even grumpy ultra-leftists like us are not too cool to vote for Bernie Sanders. So, yeah, check that out. Patreon.com/TheAntifada. Oh, also this week, we just released the first episode of a new podcast side project on the paranormal, UFOs, and space, hosted by our producer, AP Andy, where we talk about, well, I wasn't on it, but Andy talked about some cool space news, and he had on guest Stephanie Monahan to talk about UFOs and belief in conspiracy theories from a Marxist perspective.
It's like coast to coast.
Oh, wow. Yo, Communist Art Bell would be an amazing show. I would absolutely listen to Communist Art Bell the way I listen to real Art Bell. It kind of freaked me out, though.
But after Art Bell, it was, what's his face?
I thought it was Art Bell's son.
No, it was another guy. I can't remember his name now.
Don't forget Literary Hangovers. Lots of ideas.
Lots of ideas.
Lots of ideas. Literary Hangover. Oscar Wilde. I'm still recovering from the latest idea episode of Literary Hangover with Matt Leck.
All right, folks. Quick break. Fun half. 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.